Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. The next generation of supercomputers appears to be at an inflection point, promising speed and processing power that could redefine business and trigger a new industrial revolution. Read more at morganstanley.com/quantumcomputing. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money.
Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of Politico Money. We're coming at you this week from Los Angeles, California, at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, which is once again playing host to the Milken Institute Global Conference. This is a conference run by Mike Milken, who you might remember as the junk bond king in the 1980s, made a ton of money in the bond market, got busted for insider trading, and spent a little time in prison. Since then, he's built up a giant philanthropic organization and think tank, the Milken Institute, and this is the capstone event of their year here in Los Angeles. It draws all sorts of White House officials. We've had Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
And, you know, the Fed has been targeting inflation. They've been targeting 2%. So a little bit of inflation is not a problem. A little bit of inflation is a good thing. I don't see anything on the horizon to expect lots of inflation.
I did a panel yesterday with Treasury officials and officials from the CFTC and SEC, and we'll get into a little bit of that meat and potatoes later on in the podcast. But this is also famous for celebrities and sports stars. We had Tom Brady talking about his fitness routine and hydration and his loss to the Eagles in the last Super Bowl. Alex Rodriguez is going to talk about being a man in 2018 later today. And in just a little bit, I'll be heading to learn more about mindfulness from Goldie Hawn, among others. It's a crazy scene at the Hilton. The halls are absolutely jam-packed with people, everybody looking down at your lanyard to see who you are and where you're from and whether you're worth talking to. And when you go to a panel, somebody has to hold up a sign so you can follow your Sherpa to get to the panel amidst the crushing crowds. And we'll give you a little bit of a sense for that and the sound of it a little bit later in the show. But we're going to start out with a little bit of sound from Tom Brady, quarterback of the New England Patriots, talking with Jim Gray about how much it sucked to lose to the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl.
Would I rather win? Of course. I want to win. That's why I'm playing. I'm playing to win. But I'm also playing to get the most out of myself, you know, because that's, you know, I'm very fortunate to have something that I love so much as my career. So I give it everything I can. And you know, when they make those incredible plays, you know, I give them credit. Man, good for them. It sucks, but good for them, you know, because they did it.
All right. Well, the next session I'm about to walk into is the Goldie Hawn one talking about mindfulness, but wanted to give you a sense for the herds of people that are coming out of the pavilion right now. It's like a stampede from this session to the next session with lots of folks who seem to be slightly upset by the fact that it is rainy and gray in Los Angeles today. Not typical Milken weather. It's usually sunny, warm, and beautiful. Today, gray, rainy. The Wilshire Garden, a popular spot for folks to hang out during the conference, is shrouded in plastic wrap. So anyway, I'm going to fight through the crowds now and get into listen to Goldie Hawn.
I will never forget my first moment of meditating. I could actually feel and hear my own heartbeat. And the quietness actually ignited what is always in me, and I think in all of us, really. That when the clutter goes away, it was a reintroduction to me. And I felt like giggling, and that's kind of what happened to me. It's like, there was so much joy in there that I was already giggling in this room. So it was a profound experience.
That's beautiful.
That was Goldie Hawn talking about the joys of meditating. In fact, in the room you had 300 or 400 masters of the universe actually close their eyes and focus on their breath and maybe stop thinking about making money for a little while. Next, I grabbed John Carney, economics editor at Breitbart, in the hallway to discuss the representation, or lack thereof, of protectionists and true believers in Trump's economic strategies at Milken. Here's John and I talking about that topic.
Okay, so we're talking to John Carney, who is economics editor at Breitbart, right?
That's right.
Okay, I wanted to ask him, this is obviously a Milken crowd that is a little bit puzzled by the Trump administration and populism and the trade policy. What are you finding here in terms of like how Milken people react to the Trump administration and Trump world?
I think everybody is actually very curious. You're right. Puzzled is the right word. They are not used to dealing with people who think tariffs might be a good idea. It's sort of out of their window. I'm actually a little disappointed. I think they could do a better job. They don't really have a lot of people representing that point of view who aren't actually in the administration. We had Wilbur Ross here, but they could probably expand the, you know, they have a lot of speakers at this thing, and they probably could use a couple like hardcore protectionist types to just be on a panel and explain the position to people.
Yeah, somebody like Peter Navarro would probably be useful to have here to do this, because I feel like you're right. They have Wilbur Ross to do his thing, and then Mnuchin, who's not really as protectionist, but can sort of defend it. But once you get out into the panels and everything else, it's pretty much globalism everywhere you go.
It is. They say, you know, they call this like Davos under the palm trees, and there is that sort of feeling, and it's always had that sort of feeling where it is very much a sort of, let's think about problems globally, let's think about finance globally. The Milken Institute instinct is that finance can fix everything in some way or another, and so the very idea of sort of erecting trade barriers is an anathema to them. But I really do think Navarro, Lighthizer, there's people who are not in the administration at all who you could bring on to represent this point of view. They haven't quite done it. I think they'll get around to it. I think they're sort of, you know, like last year, I didn't come, but they really lacked people to represent this point of view last year. This year, they're trying a little harder. Maybe, you know, a year or two from now, they'll finally be able to have, you know, the protectionist panel.
Yeah, gotcha. And John, when you tell people as you're going around talking to them and they ask, you know, where are you from? And you say Breitbart News, what is the reaction to that? Do people like recoil and be like, oh my God, it's Breitbart and Milken? What's the reaction?
They're very curious. I mean, actually, a lot of the people who I've run into, I've met in other capacities. And actually, the question they ask me more is that exact question. Wow, what do people react like when you tell them I'm from Breitbart? Although I do have to say, the very first person who I spoke to yesterday when I first got into the conference was a young man who was like, you work for Breitbart? That is so cool. So that was nice.
Okay, so you're a bit of a celebrity in that regard that, you know, people are interested. Obviously, this Breitbart is so influential now. Any fun stuff you've done around town? Any parties? Anything that the MAGA world is doing that maybe the rest of us don't know about?
You know, I'm still on East Coast time, so I go to bed early, wake up early, you know, my friends were all going out to a second dinner. That's one of the things that happens at the Milken conference, where everybody lines up all these meetings and dinners. And so I went to one dinner, and my friends were like, hey, you want to come along to the next one? I was like, guys, it's like midnight back home. I got to go to bed.
One dinner is enough for me. I was asleep by 9:30 last night and up at 5:30, of course. John Carney, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, an excerpt from the panel I hosted on financial regulation with Craig Phillips from the Treasury Department, House Financial Services Chairman Jeb Hensarling, Republican of Texas, and several more.
And now, a word from a sponsor, a message from Morgan Stanley. The next generation of supercomputers appears to be at an inflection point, promising speed and processing power that could redefine business and trigger a new industrial revolution. Quantum computing's advanced abilities could open the door to dramatic innovation in a variety of industries. Chemical manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies, for example, could stimulate the chain of chemical reactions needed to design new and far more complex compounds and materials. And just as past industrial revolutions created many of the sectors that form the core of today's global economy, quantum computing could give rise to new companies and sectors not yet imagined. Read more at morganstanley.com/quantumcomputing. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Round of applause for our panelists.
I think that's my cue to start talking. Thank you for joining us for this financial regulations panel. I'll just introduce you to my panelists first. We've got Michael Pior, who's a commissioner at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Craig Phillips is counselor to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Jeb Hensarling, of course, is the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. We've got Chris Giancarlo, who's chair of the CFTC, and we have Ju Young Lee, who's a managing director and head of North American Financial Institutions at Fitch. All right, Mr. Chairman, I want to assess what some people think has sort of been a shift in your position towards the Senate banking bill. There was, at first, a lot of opposition on the House side from yourself and some other conservatives on the House side saying, look, this thing just doesn't go far enough. It ignores a lot of bills we pass with bipartisan support, and we are going to change it, and we want a conference and all of that. You made remarks, I think, at the American Bankers Association that suggested that, okay, you're okay with the Senate bill getting through the House as it is, going to President Trump for his signature, and then perhaps coming back with a new vehicle to pursue some of the other things that you would like to happen. Is that a correct perception? Are you now supportive of the Senate bill as it's written, passing the House, being sent to President Trump for his signature?
Not quite so. So the original marker I laid down was not that I necessarily objected to the Senate bill going forward. What I objected to was rubber stamping a bill without any negotiations between the House and the Senate. So I've had an opportunity to speak now to a number of senators on the subject, and then as the Wall Street Journal opined not all that long ago, the House is not a potted plant. You mentioned conservatives. Yes, I am a conservative, but the bills that we are trying to get done are not necessarily conservative bills. They are strongly bipartisan bills. And so I do want to give credit where credit is due to my Senate counterpart, Chairman Crapo. I wasn't quite sure the Senate was capable of anything. So we're very happy they produced a bill.
Shameless Senate bashing going on here.
Well, you know, you got to have a little fun in your job, so I'm having a little bit of fun here. No, but in all due seriousness, it was a good piece of work. It is fundamentally a sound community financial institution regulatory relief package. There does some good for our regional banks, but at the end of the day, roughly 80% of banking assets are left untouched, and it has a very modest capital formation title within the bill. And we know that roughly 80% of corporate debt comes from our capital markets. And so again, relative to history, this will be probably one of the strongest pro-growth deregulation bills that comes out of Congress and easily a decade, if not more. Relative to moving the dial on GDP growth, it's got a ways to go. So that would be my first point. And so I do believe we now have a 3% growth tax policy, but I do not believe we have a 3% growth regulatory policy, especially when it comes to banking and capital markets. I'm not saying that the roughly three dozen bipartisan bills that we have in the House get us there, but it at least helps move the needle some, and we have a dozen bills that passed unanimously. And so what I've told the Senate, and as I've met with both Republican and Democrat senators, we need a pathway for this. Efficiency would say that we put it into S-2155. If the politics doesn't work, fine, give us another avenue or give us another venue or give us another pathway to get these bills done. So I'm at least encouraged by those talks. I'm not indifferent as to the timing of when we get 2155 done. I hope it is a matter of being in the fairly near future, but I still want to make sure that we have a pathway to get these other bills from the House taken care of.
Okay, so if I can just understand what you're saying, basically, is once you're given that pathway, once you're given some guidance on how these other bills can find their way into law, then you can move forward with 2155 as it is.
Yeah, as I indicated to the Chamber of Commerce, where I spoke, happy to attend multiple signing ceremonies in the White House. Okay. You know, you get a collection of pens. I got two teenagers. They like mm-hmm. the pens. So, yes, I'm more than happy to go to multiple signing ceremonies.
It's a perfect segue to you, Ju Young. I'm interested in your views on, first, what's in 2155, the Senate banking bill. There is a general consensus that this is
relatively reasonable reform. It had Senate Democrats in support of it, mainly focused on community banks, not a lot of relief for the largest banks. Talk about that in particular and how it impacts the ratings on these banks and the risks that these banks face. And more broadly, all you're hearing about efforts to deregulate in this space, how is that going to impact the banking industry, the safety and soundness of these banks that you follow?
Sure. So I'm taking a bit of a different perspective. As a rating agency, we generally try to take the perspective of creditors. And so from our perspective, a lot of this post-crisis regulation has actually been quite aligned with creditors' interests. So if you think about higher capital standards, higher liquidity standards, better governance or rules requiring better governance, those are all things that help the credit profiles of banks. And in fact, I'd say right now we're looking at banks, they have probably the best capital levels, the best liquidity levels, very strong governance, the best we've probably seen in quite some time. And I think things like stress testing and, most importantly, resolution planning have really done a lot to improve the safety and soundness of the banking system, and I think has given the market a lot of confidence in banks. So there is a risk, I think, from our perspective in terms of deregulation, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, there's less credit availability, you know, but our study has shown that actually loan growth post-crisis, if you look at the 2011 period on, has really outpaced GDP and in some asset classes has been, you know, multiples of GDP, and so very healthy growth. And the one factor that is sort of holding back loan growth in the post-crisis period has really been the fact that the housing sector, because of foreclosure, has taken a longer time to recover. So actually, loan growth's been pretty good from our perspective. We look at earnings, which is the one thing I think where banks haven't fully recovered. That's partly been because of the low interest rate environment that we're in, as well as I think structurally regulation has probably taken something out of bank earning profiles. We've spent a lot of time looking at the Financial Choice Act. We've spent a lot of time looking at the Senate bill. Those are all things that we're paying a lot of attention to because I think you're right. From a big bank perspective, they're probably not going to get a lot of relief, and the smaller banks will. But we view that with some caution because I think if you look at, for example, like a 10% leverage ratio, which is a simple, I know that was part of the original Choice Act, when we did an analysis of all the banks that failed between 2007 and 2011, and it was quite a lot of bank failures at the time, these were mostly smaller institutions, 35% of them failed with a 10% leverage ratio. So you have to be careful to make sure that that's, you know, you still have to look at risk-based measures, and I do think from a bank creditor's perspective, those prudential requirements are quite important. And so we are looking at that with some level of caution. I think we will acknowledge that regulation probably has had some unintended consequences a little bit differently than some of you may be thinking about. You know, there's been talk about the liquidity in the bond markets changing because banks have not been, you know, the broker dealers, they've not had as much inventory. But I think from our perspective, we look at that and we say, you know, there has been the risk that some bank management teams are over-relying on CCAR as opposed to doing their own. I mean, they're all doing their own stress tests too, and we actually think that's really important. But to the extent that they over-rely on regulator stress tests as opposed to their own, we also look at whether or not, you know, these management teams are going to start dividending out a lot of capital. And at this time in the cycle where, you know, asset quality has been at an all-time peak, the credit environment's very benign. And if you start to lower capital requirements, then, you know, I think the timing could be an issue.
Mm-hmm. I want to pivot a little bit to fintech and Bitcoin and blockchain technology. And Chris, I think this gives you an opportunity to tell these people your crypto dad story and how you became known as a crypto dad.
So it's really remarkable. Who would have thought that a Senate testimony broadcast on C-SPAN would have led to 49,000 Twitter followers? But I, along with Mike's colleague, Jay Clayton, I testified in front of the Senate Banking Committee on February 6th. And I had prepared a 45-page, 160-footnote written testimony. And I was going through it the night before, and I was thinking, oh, my God, this is as dry as dust, and I've got to go in front of this banking committee tomorrow. So I actually put it aside, and when I got in front of the committee, I said, Senators, I've submitted a long written statement, but if you don't mind, I'd like to speak to you just extemporaneously, and I'd like to speak to you for a moment, not as the chairman of a regulatory agency, but as a dad. I said, I've got three college-age kids. I said, when they were in high school, we opened up small brokerage accounts for them. We hope they might trade a stock or two and learn about the stock market. Well, no interest whatsoever. But something's changed in the last few months, and that something is Bitcoin. I said, suddenly all my kids want to talk about is Bitcoin. And I said, I was away for our family ski trip, and all I heard about from them and their cousins and my nieces and nephews was Bitcoin. And it struck me, and this was my point I made to the Senate, that I think we need to take a moment and respect this generational interest in this new instrument, not with derision, but with a little bit of attention and respect and respond with policy initiatives that really are thoughtful and forward-looking. Well, my Twitter account exploded. As it was happening, it was ringing behind me, and my assistant had to turn it off, and by the end of the week, I had over 40,000 Twitter followers at Six Expanded. And I've been teased in the media, as you know, but believe me, I was not encouraging this. It just happened from a congressional testimony. I mean, who would have thought it? Yeah. But what people reacted to is there is something going on here that's generational. I think there's just as the baby boomer generation lost faith in the leaders that came before them and tried to seek a cultural change in those days through sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But I think there's a generation here that also has lost faith in us that led them through the financial crisis, and they see technology as a way of disintermediating institutions that for which they don't have a great deal of respect. And I think there is something here that is worthy of greater attention, and it's really just aside from what we're grappling with is how do our old rule frameworks deal with this new application? Our rules were written in the 1930s, as were the SEC's. And really couldn't contemplate anything like this. And we are struggling to find out how we apply an old law to really new and very different applications.
Yeah. I would just close on the note that my kid's 9-year-old's baseball team is called the Ad Hoc Crypto Team. So a very well-named. I want to thank Chris, Chairman Hensarling, Ju Young, Craig, and Mike for a great panel. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you later.
Okay, that's a wrap for this week's Politico Money, coming to you from Los Angeles and the Milken Institute Global Conference. Hope you enjoyed just a snapshot of what life is like here. Hopefully they'll allow us back next year, even though I'm currently sitting in the hallway with a jacket over my head recording this close for you all, so it sounds decent. These are the glories of podcasting. Thank you to my producer, Bridget Mulcahy. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts, rate us, and write a written review, and we'll be back with you next week.